Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This week's Rock On Tours was recorded before the passing of Jeff Beck.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. I love what you're wearing. That's a fantastic shirt.
Why, thank you. And also, I love that you've got on a blue hat.
For a blue day. Oh, me and you, we just love plus one, aren't we?
We are Love Plus One, exactly. And in fact, I've come all the way to Durham, so I'm actually north of a miracle right now.
So if you haven't sussed out who's on, then you really shouldn't be listening. But it's Nick Heywood, Haircut 100.
Haircut 100. And the burning question is, Gary, because I see you've got a nice knitted jumper on.
Yes.
Is it tucked into your trousers?
It's not. It should be, though, shouldn't it, if it was 1981.
It was 1981. Mind you, I think that says more about how thin we all were that you could even contemplate tucking a jumper into your trousers.
Now it's just a thin personality. No, the other day I mentioned you were tour managing and then we never mentioned it again. And so there's lots of people out there thinking, who's he tour managing? Is he just really on the road again? But you are
yes,
on the road.
I am on the road. I'm going to give him a plug. I'm in the fabulous 40 Winks guest house in Durham, who've given me a room specially to do this podcast, although I think Georgie might walk in at any time. Because, yeah, I'm on tour with my missus, Georgia Bing, who is a children's author. She wrote the Molly Moon books, but she's got a new book out called Albie the Glowing Cowboy. And we're going around schools. She's talking to schools, talking to kids to try and let them know that they're all writers. So everyone can write. It's a creative thing. It's really lovely.
Yeah. So are you laying out the trestle table and organising the piles of books for her?
I'm helping her setting up getting the speakers connected. And yeah, we've got all sorts of props and stuff. I went and got some posters printed today. I am a proper tour manager.
Are you wearing corduroy with elbow pads? Are you smoking a pipe?
No, I'm in black and wearing shorts like a proper crew.
Wow. Okay. So, Nick Heywood. This is going to be really nice, digging back into the 80s, obviously, but we'll also bring you up to date. And I know he's doing a show very soon with Steve Norman from Spandau Ballet.
Oh, there you go. Because, yeah, no, we'll talk about this with him, because I was wondering, because you were pretty well established by the time they showed up, weren't you? So
Yeah. They were the new kids on the block.
Yeah.
They sort of made pop happen, in a way.
It was that absolute turnaround where it was like kind of them, ABC, and all that sort of stuff seemed to happen at the same time, and suddenly everything went sort of funky, poppy, didn't it?
Anyway, he's waiting for us in Florida, apparently.
Well, let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience.
Oh, yeah,
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
It's funny, for a while we were worried because you were a bit late that Nick Heywood had gone wayward.
Yes, well, Wayward Heywood has been passed around the band like a rugby ball many a time. You know.
You sound gorgeous. It's so nice to have someone who's got a mic.
Ah, right. Well, I was trying to get it through the duet and it's set to sound richer and stuff, but it's nicer when it's like less rich, if you know what I mean. Does it sound okay?
We don't need a duet.
Good.
I mean, who have you got there? Martin Fry or Tony Bennett?
Now, Nick, you and I have had two meetings over the years. We spent a very enjoyable evening at a dinner at Mark Fox's house.
Yes, in Notting Hill Gate.
Your percussionist who then became... Yes.
Before the divorce.
One of you were... Yes, indeed. Lovely house that was. We were, yeah. It ended very badly. And but the other one, which is really funny, is which is years before, is one of the first sessions I ever did. It was when I was in the Australian band Ice House, and our agent, John Giddings, who is now a Source for the Secrets agent, got me the gig to go and do a Top of the Pops pre-record or re-record with you. Well, I wasn't even going to do Top of the Pops. I just had to go to a studio where you and your band were and not do anything.
Oh, that's a good gig. Well, that sounds like a perfect gig to me.
Yeah. Not remember.
Yeah. And
how did it go?
The only thing I really remember is it was the first time I ever met Tim Renick.
Oh, who wonderful.
I then played with in Pink Floyd. But I'm thinking, because I know Pino played on that album. I don't know if it was Pino Palladino who was meant to be doing Top of the Pops. That would be the start of my lifetime of getting jobs because Pino was busy.
What a band. I mean, you know, in hindsight, well, what a band. Amazing. I mean, talk about taking it for granted.
You had all the boys. I've got to say, the list on your solo album is so impressive.
Well, I met Pino in a little demo studio in Islington, actually. And just chatting to somebody, and I was doing a song, a sort of demo of a song. And I said, you know anybody that's got good at fretless? Because at that particular time, Christian, do you remember, by the China Crisis, had just come out. And it was just lovely, this lovely fretless stuff and Mick Kahn. And it was flowing around, wasn't it? It was in the air, like fretless bass.
There was a moment where everyone was playing fretless. Yeah. A lot of us just sort
of pretended. I think he's right, you know, Mick Kahn. Would you not say he was the biggest influence on people turning to the fretless?
Oh, yeah, by far, yeah. Yeah, probably, I mean, if we asked Pino, he'd probably say it was Mick Kahn that made him get a fretless. Who knows? I don't know. But it'd be an interesting subject, wouldn't it, to do the kind of like history and the evolution of the fretless?
Yeah, if you wanted your audience to
quite interesting.
Slowly turn on.
Well, it's gone in and out of favour, hasn't it? You know, it goes in and then sometimes it becomes like the sound you really don't want to hear. And that's what we've had. You know, we've gone through the 90s. I mean, fretless bass in the 90s, I mean, forget it. You know, Britpop and fretless bass are like...
That's right. You need a big fret for Britpop, don't you?
Yeah.
all fret. It was all fret, wasn't it?
Yeah. But then again, the ponytail made a reappearance in the 90s, didn't it? You know, so the fretless bass used to go hand in hand with the ponytail.
With the ponytail and the waist and the waistcoat.
Yeah, yeah.
Who played ponytail on your album? I can't.
I actually fell into the ponytail around about 2001. I was in it, living in California, and my hair got longer and longer. And it was that moment when you think, well, I might not have hair in 10 years or 20 years. So what am I going to do with this? So I went full long. And then tying it into ponytail, and there was that moment where I thought, oh, my God, I've turned into that guy. I always didn't want to. I spent two decades taking the piss out of those guys.
That's amazing to see because you are so, I mean, you look ridiculous. You've clearly got a portrait in your attic because you look so fantastically preserved. But your hair has always been that. I can't imagine it's ever grown.
I've never had it cut.
Can I just say, if we had a sort of a court sketcher who was just drawing the last two minutes of conversation, we would have had now a portrait of Nick Beggs.
That's true. His fretless is pretty, is out of something else, isn't it? His fretless. And that's the stick.
Yeah.
The Chapman stick he plays?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I actually did a bass off with him once on a radio show where we actually did Deliverance. Did a ding, 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 ding with him playing the stick.
So this is a chap who moved from Jamiroquai. Sorry, not Jamiroquai. Am I talking about? What was his first band? Kajagoogoo. Sorry, I knew there were a few syllables in it. Kajagoogoo all the way to prog rock and Stephen Wilson and the rest, right? I mean, this is...
Yeah.
Hugely credible musician. I say that now backtracking in case he's listening and getting upset.
No, we love Nick. We love Nick.
Do you remember, Gary, being in that club in South Ken outside the station, just across the road? We used to go there quite regularly. That's where I remember hearing Kajagoogoo's record for the first time, in that club. Do you remember it was like a bar and a little sort of like tiny little club at the back?
Like,
what was it called?
Guy,
do you remember just across the road from the station?
Guy knows all of them.
I can't think of that one. I mean, it sounds like it's near where Bruges is.
And we first heard, we to think of that, Nick, we first heard Kajagoogoo together.
I remember discussing the bass with you.
Did you call an immediate war conference?
You look like you've got a permanent setup there in America. Is this your home now, or do you have two homes?
I have an American wife, so we live here for the winter and then there for the rest of the year. So we live in the UK mostly, but it's just coming here. And so this is it's all I really need with my setup. It's been like that since my flat in 1982. So I just need some speakers. It used to be a drum machine, but now it's a Duet.
A yacht.
I can carry this. That's how big my yacht got.
I have to say, that toy yacht is so you.
It's not a toy, it's a model, toy.
It's even got a name.
So what's it called?
Wind Moth.
Nice. Was that such a song?
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Well, it's just, there is a story behind it, but it's too boring for this podcast.
It's hard to rhyme.
Gary and I are now racking our, we went quiet for a second there as we racked our brains, go, fuck, what album?
Wind Moth sounds a bit fretless, doesn't it, actually? I could definitely imagine a jazz album called Wind Moth. They're a band, even.
I was trying to rhyme it.
I'd go see Wind Moth. Maybe that'll be us going to see Wind Moth in a few years with a fretless bass and jazz hats.
Nick Begg did it.
Yeah, we're being a band with Nick Begg's called Wind Moth.
Nick Begg's Wind Moth. That's what
I want to see.
It's very close to Wim Hof.
Live at Montreux.
Triple album, obviously. Yeah. Oh, listen, mate. We do need to talk about those early days. Obviously.
Yeah.
Steve Dagger, who managed Spandau Ballet, reminded me.
Does he not manage them now?
If Spandau Ballet exists in any form.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it does. It always will. It's eternal, isn't it? I mean, Spandau Ballet is there. Whether we like bands or not, whether they're together or not, they exist and people love them. And so we should cherish them all.
You're absolutely.
That's what I think. I mean, to me, the Specials, I know Terry's now sadly not here, but. The Specials are the Specials and will always be, you know.
That's a beautiful
way. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's like saying, you know, Psycho exists, right? They're not still filming it. Those actors aren't around, but it still exists. It's out there as a piece of art. And
of every film you could have thought. Not the Sound of Music.
Okay. You're right. But I'm just thinking of something iconic is what I was thinking. So, and you know, we think of that. We know these records still exist because people still play them. I mean, and Pelican West is coming out as a 40th anniversary special edition very soon. But you're right. The bands sort of do exist, don't they? They exist in people's hearts. In their history. Yeah. Thank you.
There will be people discovering Psycho for the first time, and it'll be their film. There'll be somebody discovering Spandau Ballet, Haircut 100, you know, the Specials. And I've met people that, you know, just got into the Specials or something, and they're doing that. And, you know, California, that was a place where the Specials were huge and getting bigger and bigger as it goes on. Sometimes just countries and places and cultures just grab hold of a band and some music, and they run with it. It just resonates with them.
Well, it's interesting, is it? Because that whole Scar thing, how that shaped so much American 90s music, didn't it?
No Doubt, I think it was, that were really influenced.
No Doubt, for instance, yeah. But there's other bands.
Yeah.
We need to go back to your influences then.
Yes.
And you as a young kid growing up in, fill in the gap.
South London, you know. I mean, the influences were, I would imagine were pretty similar, you know, because we were brought up in London and, you know, and influenced all the same, had all the same influences. But, you know, how we filter them through, I think is different and unique. It's why Spandau Ballet became Spandau Ballet. You know, all your unique influences all gelled in rehearsal room somewhere in Islington and it like exploded. But, you know, that moment when you think we're going to be serious, we're going to be a band, we're going to do this. It's when you have to throw all the influences away and be something new, you know.
Yeah.
That's the moment. That's the moment where you really do have a chance at actually being, offering something new to the table. You know when you, because you've been cutting your teeth up until that point, haven't you? You've been kind of like being like your heroes. I mean, we were like Talking Heads for about a month, so much like Talking Heads. We could have done Talking Heads. I think we played at the Wellington Waterloo and trying to jump on the mod Scar revival kind of thing. And we were just like Talking Heads. And it was just kind of this guy coming and says, "You're not mod," you know, and I couldn't argue with him. It was like, no, we weren't really, but we had Hush Puppies on.
So you had a version of Psycho Killer, as it were.
Yeah, it was a bit like that. I mean, I had a song called Worldwide Dangers, you know, and singing it in the Wellington Waterloo at the height of the mod revival, and I'm singing about worldwide dangers and going, scratchy. And I was into the Feelies as well, and just like American music, you know.
What about you as a kid?
Jonathan Richmond and the Modern Lovers. Oh, yeah. You know, I love the simplicity of all that music.
Well, actually,
how can they be that brilliant and that simple?
I think there's something in this, in that there is a kind of wry, oblique, slanted, side-eye look at the world in a kind of pop, tongue-in-cheek sort of way that Jonathan Richmond, even Talking Heads do, that certainly is what I feel you were doing at the same time. Or eventually successful.
Yeah, I mean, for the early influences were jazz, because it was my father, and he was just into jazz and big band. You know, I got to see Oscar Peterson, which was amazing. Ray Charles and Count Basie on one bill. Woody Herman. Just so many greats. It was just I didn't know what they were. I was just going along with Dad, and I thought this was amazing to spend time with Dad. Like, I loved spending time with Dad at his toy factory, you know, to get to play with Saw Figa for the whole afternoon, digging my hands in the green. You know that green slime that workers,
yeah,
you know?
Your dad had a toy factory?
Yeah, yeah. He that was his dream. He was in the Prince in Brixton.
That my dad was in the Prince.
Really? Ah. Yeah, was he a union man,
so
too? Because my dad was a union man in the Prince.
He had Saw Figa at home as well.
Did he?
Nick Begg Swarfiger.
That's how you got those just fingers to be so fast, isn't it? Swarfiger. That's a good name for a jazz band.
Yeah. So go on, how toy factory. Explain.
He had this lovely toy factory which I looked at not so long ago, and it's still there, and it's a little playgroup now. It's a kids, it's like a little playgroup.
What kind of toys did he make?
Wonderful.
What kind of toys did he make?
For the GLC, he made he repaired toys and he made toys. His company was called Gemco.
Toys are kind of in Haircut 100 Nick Hayward lyrics, aren't they? I always feel there's a sort of nursery, childlike connection, dream world that's in your lyrics. There's a yacht. There's a model. Sorry, not a toy. Yacht right behind you.
I don't know if you remember, but that time in 1981, 1982 was really naive. Do you remember how naive it was with Scottish bands as well? You know, like
Postcard,
Altered Images. Yeah, with the whole postcard thing. I liked that. I resonated with that because that kind of whole, you know, that this it's not childish. It's childlike. You know, that whole innocence and naivety. It was really getting real in 1982. Everybody was wearing bits of fur, weren't they, on their collars, you know?
Yeah, well, and there's some pictures of me and Martin wearing exactly that. I mean, we'd be running to Lawrence Corner to try and find stuff that looked like Elmer Fudd would wear it.
Yeah, and it was
Arctic explorers.
Exactly, it was about looks, wasn't it? It was very Boy Scout. Bringing their past into the present at that particular time, you know, everything that they'd done as a child was suddenly boyzone. It was very much, you know, the image of the time.
There were things like Brideshead Revisited on BBC as well, weren't there? Which I think was a big on people. And there was this thing of being smart. It was a sort of reaction to, you know, after the whole post-punk thing, the whole kind of.
But you're right as well, because Sebastian Flight had the teddy bear and there were. In a way, a kind of return of the British whimsy, which probably hadn't had been around 10 years earlier with Genesis and the psychedelic scene, you know, nursery crime, etc.
Yeah, which I'd grown up with. I mean, that was one of my favourite albums. You know, I was listening to that and going off into a dream world. You know,
Well, you had an older brother, didn't you? Who was
Entangled? Ripples? You know, you can't listen to Ripples without going off into another world.
Yeah.
That chorus is probably, you know, there I was like, I don't know, 9, 10, just listening to this music and just drifting away and thinking, this is where I want to go to. You know, first it was, look, you'd listen and you'd hear Bowie going off, and, you know, we'd go on holidays and we'd be driving through, I know, the gorgeous de Verdon at one particular point, and it was this beautiful sunshine, and then you've got Diamond Dogs playing, and then you've got Pink Floyd playing, and then you've got Dave Brubeck. And this was the soundtrack at the time. Music was just in the car, always. It was in the house. It was everywhere.
He was quite ahead then, wasn't he? Was he a young guy?
Well, that was where my brother's influence came on, because I had the older brother who was the guy that bought all the stuff. You know, he was the pioneer.
He was in bands, wasn't he?
He would.
Yeah.
He's the reason I know Little Feet. You know, when I first heard Rock and Roll Doctor, you know, it was just another thing. And that he introduced me to the Doobie Brothers. You know, and it was
let's
all
just to stop for a second. Doobie Brothers, that guitar sound, you know, singing it. You're not getting far away from what you eventually ended up doing with Haircut. Just thought I'd join.
Yeah, yeah, it was Average White Band as well. I mean, I had all those albums, you know, with Cut the Cake and Pick Up the Pieces. I was you know, and when I, you know, it was, I picked up the guitar because Pete was the guitarist. So guitars were in the house, you know. When he was out, I pop into his room and pick up that guitar, and he showed me D, you know, D major, you know. Practiced it for ages. Then he'd be rehearsing, because then with the house, the toy factory went, sadly. Dad's dream went down the pan, and so we had to come up with a solution. Aww. So he was spraying furniture white, which shows the time, you know, you had Habitat, and everything was kind of going
say
white.
You have a white pair of speakers behind you, don't you?
Well, I think I've continued his dream, you know. He had a company called You Name It, We Spray It. And so he was spraying white.
Well, brilliant. But did you know, back in, there's an interview with Paul McCartney in about 1965. And they talk about what ideas you'd have outside of music. And he said, I'd like a shop where you can just buy white things. You know, it's really hard to get white things, like nice white cups, nice white. So basically the white company, Paul McCartney, had the idea in the 60s. And what
did your dad spray a Beatles album? So I guess now we are now entering you guys meeting up as friends somewhere, you and Les, and you know, the heart of what became your band. Was it at school?
Well, firstly, we're all musicians in our areas with the dream, so, and the influence, you know. So I was in Beckenham listening to, going round to mates' houses, we put on Seven Seas of Rye, pretend to be asleep at the intro, and then slowly wake up, pick up our instruments, and then mime the rest of it. So that was our band. I think we were called BC Klett. My pretentious sort of take on bicycle and bikes and the girl with the balloon, boy with the balloon, and these things I used to see when I tried to get to bunk off school so that I could see
that
film
of the Italian. Do you think you were
soaking
up? You're talking about
Italian films?
You're talking about Le BC Klett de Bell's size, aren't you? Do you know that film?
Yes, I love that.
Right. You would love it. It's a short. Yeah.
No, I know it. It's on that. It's on that DVD set of five films,
so it's
about London.
Set in Hampstead, Belfast Park, and it's a musical of some kind, of strange. With a chap on a bicycle, and go on.
But I'm just wondering, Nick, if some of this is you soaking up some of the inherent pretentiousness that was in the air from the Beckenham Arts Lab.
Well, I was growing up in David Bowie's.
There you go. Black room, chained to the radio.
I mean, this was it.
Sorry.
Fame was really close by. You know, I thought that the dream is possible, because he, God of art, came from here. You know, we were going to the Three Tons. That was our local. Right. So we were going to his art lab. We were going to his place. You know, this was where he was from. You know, where did he, you know, let's search. Let's try and find out where God lived, you know. And, we were just, fame was always around in Beckenham. It was even across the road. Outside of my letterbox, I used to see Bunty James from How. She lived across the road. And
wow.
She, yeah. And
Wow.
And yeah. Steve was a lovely lady who had a huge green car like a Lancaster.
She was just below Jack Hargreaves, wasn't she?
Well, Jack Hargreaves is a massive Haircut 100 influence.
What?
Massive. Oh, yeah. The back sleeve where Graham is dressed up as an adventurer, because he's become Jack Hargreaves now. He's living the Jack Hargreaves life. I think we're all now living the life that we aspired to. You know, you aspire to these things and you become them. He became a tree surgeon. And you go to Graham when you want to know stuff, about weather and about fishing and about surfing, because he went down to Cornwall and he's doing
surfing. Jack Hargreaves' great show up? Was it the country show? What was that?
Country Life. Was it Country Life? Was it called Country? No.
People are,
that's a Google.
They're Googling now. But I do remember it, and it was done in a little sort of faux fishing hut, wasn't it, that he used to with his tackle.
Yeah, and he had a pipe on, and he would just sit there relaxed and calm and tell you stuff that you really wanted to know.
But that, you know, that's so funny, because that is kind of haircutty, isn't it? That's sort of...
Yes, all yeah.
I mean, that's what a band is,
you have
though,
that sort of Blue Peter kind of Jack Onori.
Yeah, another huge influence. Right the way through, that's why all the TV shows I was name dropping all over as lyrics, as like Marine Boy and Squiddly Diddly and everything. It was all in there. Everything was an influence. It felt like everything was colliding at that particular time. I mean, back to that first band where we were rehearsing in front rooms and to Seven Seas of Rye and brilliant intros, was setting me up, I think, as a songwriter, because I was thinking, what's the thing at the beginning? What is this? I didn't know it was called an intro, but I thought, that's exciting. That's exciting. The fact that you can... And it's like, that happens on the other song called Pinball Wizard, doesn't it? Yeah, that's really exciting. I love that. That's what you've got to have in these things called songs. You've got to have really exciting intros that grab you. So when I would go and play D, I just thought, okay, Seven Seas Arrive, Pinball Wizard, here we go, D, you know, and you're just trying to find something. You're trying to find shapes and chords, and you realize that when you play this bar chord, you can play it all the way, you can play it anywhere. So I just didn't know about music at all, but I knew that you could play this F major 7 chord anywhere. It sounds brilliant. And that ended up being Favorite Shirts, where at first of it was just Talking Heads, and it was just playing that for hours in my bedroom, just going like, this, you know, wow, oh, I'm funking. I am funk now. I'm this close to average.
I'm
this close to average white band, you know. And then you think, but what do they do? They're, you know, oh, how do we sound like that? So then going back to that first band, school band kind of thing, you know, I was doing that. Les was in his band, I think Heavy Syrup in Croydon. And they were kind of.
I know somebody used to wear one of those.
It was that German promoter, wasn't it?
You know, Graham was full blown punk. You know, he was. When I first met him, he was actually head to toe in Clash. He had the hat. You know, he had I think he had chains everywhere. And I was kind of like this tall, skinny chap looking like the Clash. I just thought, yeah. And he was going out with Alison, who Alison Blower was a key, because I think all the girlfriends were key players in a band, you know, launching a band, definitely. Because I know this for a fact, that if our girlfriends had not decided to throw in the towel with us at the same time, we wouldn't have got it together and focused on being in the band. Because up until that point, we are guys in bands. And then you had, you know, your girlfriends, and it's very comfortable, and we all meet on a Saturday because it's like you worked and then you're rehearsing, so everybody's meeting up, and it's nice, and the girls drink tea and you do play your little songs, and it's all great. Then when the girls decided to throw in the towel and we're just cut loose, we suddenly thought, right, okay, let's do this properly. And that was that moment, that real moment of, you know, we started hunting together. We started hunting clothes, females. We started hunting for culture, everything together. And we became driven We lived together in Gloucester Road above a flower shop.
So was that that showed your commitment, did it? This is sort of like, let's go to London, let's just concentrate on the band, no more.
I tell that to every band now, even. I say, you know, if you want to do it, then just, you know, go and live and breathe being in a band.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, or you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
I mean, I was lucky enough to be living at home with mum and dad, who weren't comfortable financially, but I had a job. I was working at the Financial Times. And I thought, if I'm going to get this band together, I can't stay in this job because I'm getting more and more comfortable. I get a wage packet every week. Right. It's going to have to go on the dole and like spend all my time.
And you were getting a lot for that column, weren't you, Gary?
That's a pretty impressive first job, Gary.
My first job is actually for Islington Health in the Town Hall. But then I worked at the Financial Times as a clerk. Once I messed up I had to calculate the rate between the dollar and the pound, and I messed it up and it printed. And I got called into the editor's office, who really went crazy. And he said, "You don't tell anyone about this." I'd done more to destroy capitalism that day.
You sank British Leyland, didn't you?
Than any copy of Marxist Worker Weekly or whatever. But sorry. Yes, though, the commitment. Yes, the commitment.
Yeah. That's it. Commitment starts at anything, doesn't it? Any kind of
I want to just
adventure.
Mention what Dagger said to me, which is he remembers Steve Dagger, because I'd forgotten. I was talking about that, and then we got sidetracked with Nick Beggs or whatever. And he said he met you and your band in mid-1981 in a bloke called Moles in his office in Marlborough Court. And a mole is John Baker. And John Baker went on to run and head G Street Records and, you know, came a lot of American rap bands and bands in the 90s were successful. And he said he remembers you playing the tracks to him, and they were very Beatles/Monkeys, he said, not quite as funky at that time as they became. Do you remember that?
Well,
he said you're also transfixed by Mole's pet snake.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was Carnaby Street, just off Carnaby Street.
Yeah, where Marlborough court, a little court.
Ah, that's it.
Off Carnaby.
Yes, yeah, because that was it. we were felt like that day we were about to really, really make it. We were going to see Steve Dagger, Spandau Ballet's manager. We're having a meeting with Steve Dagger, and we walked in and he has a pet snake. We thought this was so rock and roll, and he had his own office, and it was in Carnaby Street.
Well, Carnaby Street.
Yeah. You know,
it's with Mole.
And so, and because I know that Haircut 100 would not have taken off had it not been for Chart Number One. That's why I've always got the total respect for you and the guys, because Chart Number One was definitely part of the whole Britpop, the Brit funk revival that was going on. You know, it was almost like you were helping Chris Sullivan out. You know, it's like, here we go. Here's a chance for Blue Rondo a la Turk. Yeah. It's like you were suddenly spreading the wave.
Was it the same time as Tears and
Not
Enough?
Yeah, and Funkapolitan ABC, and yeah. Pig Bag. And...
Do you know, it's hard to remember exactly. I think it was obviously an influence. And I remember when the club scene slightly shifted and the Beatroot Club started in Soho, as you know, one of our friends had started one night at the Beatroot on a Friday night. And Robert Elms was also doing a club called the Sam Ritz. We were going back and playing a lot more funk stuff, which was partly our roots from being soul boys in the late 70s. And so there was a lot more of that on the DJ's decks with credibility.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was. Yeah. Yeah. And I tell you why, because there was a band called The Freeze, wasn't there? Southern Freeze. I nicked that title. Second, one of the songs Spandau did in the electronic period was called The Freeze, and it's where it stopped.
Yeah.
I think there was definitely an influence of those bands, yeah.
I was noticing that you guys were getting funkier, you know, and that's what it was, and it was in the air. There were the clubs that we all used to go to, but we needed to dance, and I think that was what it was, and we just danced to all those great records, and it was influencing, it was becoming a thing, and we're also getting better musicians, better as musicians, so that we could actually start to make the stuff that we loved, because up until that point you do what you can do, but when you get better you can do more, can't you? I mean, that's what happened. I mean, with us, when Blair Cunningham joined, that's when we could be a world-class
Did that happen?
Well, I just recall going to the, it was called the Mooch Club, but it was actually the Wag. It was a night that we had the Mooch Club, and it was going to see Blair there. He was playing with Shake Shake, who was Mark and Phil had introduced us through our, you remember Carl Adams?
Well, Carl
was
Adams
our manager at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, Carl was an old Blitz kid from one of the clubs.
Yeah, he was a Blitz kid. And Lacey Lady, he knew all that. So he was, so when he saw us in the linen cupboard at the Ski Club of Great Britain rehearsing, when, you know, because he used to come, how I met him was he used to supply stuff that you put, people put stuff up their nose and stuff.
Yeah,
like
right.
I don't know what that was, but anyway, it was that my brother was just into anything that could like take him off into even more glorious lands in the world. You know, he'd be listening to all this beautiful music, but he was living and breathing it, so he loved that stuff. So that's how I met Carl. This guy poked his head around the corner and said, you know, your band kind of thing. I was just, Pete's band, you know, Pete, my brother. You're like, yeah. We're just squeezed into this tiny linen cupboard, just rehearsing, doing.
But Carl also knew Steve Dagger, and I think Steve Dagger was a sort of, there were a lot of people who wanted to be like Steve Dagger, you know. So Graham Ball ended up managing.
But all our influences started to appear, didn't they? You know, I mean, Robert Elms probably went to the Lady Lacey. Carl went to the Lacey Lady. You know, Carl was suddenly like, there's this band I've just seen, and they sound like funky and. Wow, they, you know, and you know what it's like. He was probably at that point where he was thinking, "Oh, I'm going to manage bands," and then suddenly there was a young band.
So, did he get you the contract, and where did he put you on?
Well, up until that point, we were kind of like, because we're living at the above the flower shop in South Ken, and so we're going up to Ken Market to get, you know, hunt for clothes up there. But we also played at the college there, and that's where we played with it. We supported a band called the Tropicanos, where Lascelles and Herschel were the brass section, which is where we started. They became the brass section on Favorite Shirts. We invited them to play because it was an evolutionary process of, because it was Les Graham and I. That's what it was at first. We didn't even have a drummer. We found Pat and in the Melody Maker, and it didn't quite work out because we just needed to be more solid. And so that was when we found Blair at the Mooch Club. You know, he joined, and then we needed sax and and Phil knew his mate Mark, and you know, he was this percussionist who looked like one of Spandau Ballet. He actually looked like one of you guys, because we
I guess you guys did.
To be men, and we were kind of like three kind of oiks from Beckenham. You know, we were, you know, we were sort of 5'10" and sort of 9 stone, you know, kind of thing, and no stubble, you know.
Yeah, thin enough to tuck a jumper into your trousers.
Yeah, we were very indie. We were like indie. But when we met you guys at the, we used to go out and sort of like spot one of you at the Beetroot or something. It's like, they're like 6'2" or something. And they're sort of like got stubble and they're only got hairy chest. Look at Martin, Martin Kemp's hairy chest. You know, and then Tony, it's like, Jesus,
giant.
Look at this guy. You know, he's a big man, he's in condition as well. You know, he's just stand there like this. You know,
he's a big fella.
Yeah, big fella. But he's not out of shape. With him as well. And I like no. that about Spandau. I like the fact that you know these guys were dressing art, but you didn't want to mess with them. I liked that kind of toughness about it.
Yeah. Can I just have a sidebar on Blair Cunningham? Because Guy, do you know who his brother was?
His brother was Cunningham, right?
Who died in the Otis Redding plane crash.
Yeah,
he played the bar case.
Because it's a huge family, isn't it? Because the parents were musicians, weren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, you should hear Blair's story. It's quite something. You know, I mean, he's drumming in a local recording studio for Stax, and the records that he's played on, and how he cut his teeth and learned to be a musician and play less. I mean, and we met him. He played with Robbie Johnson, I think, and the Jacksons. And who was it that he was playing with? He was playing with a sort of like new wave band, you know, because he later... He was in that crowd, that new wave crowd, and I think he joined the Pretenders later as well.
That's right, he did. He joined the Pretenders for a bit.
So he's just that drummer. He's in the pocket, as Matt Bakker says.
That's your secret weapon, wasn't he, in Haircut?
Oh, the joy to play with him. I mean, everything went up, you know.
But also, you always had, because from day one, you always had really sophisticated horn arrangements. Your lines were all, that was all really posh.
Yeah, I mean, it was that, and then meeting Bob Sargent.
This is an interesting one. Yeah, because Bob Sargent, who produced all the John Peel sessions up to then, wasn't he? And you were the kind of star of his 80s, if you will. He was like a real post-punk guy, wasn't he? He'd done the Fall.
Atomic Rooster.
He'd had this sort of prog career, hadn't he? Yeah. And then he became an engineer. But then you were the start of his glossy 80s.
Yeah, look at all those influences. Like, that was happening. He was the guy who was going to, like, make our pop record for us. He was employed to be that guy that would bring it all together as a cohesive thing to make a pop record.
He'd done the beat, hadn't he?
Yeah, he'd done the... That's why we went to him.
Yeah.
That's why we signed to Arista, because of the beat. So we were in there. This was it. We'd chosen to be like that. And we're in there. We're making favorite shirts because it was our funky sounding song. And he turned it into a pop record. That's the master of a producer. But look at the influences that he came through to get to that stage. And like John Gallen, the engineer, I was just chatting to him. And it's the 100 Chalk Farm Road next to the Roundhouse, which is where I'd seen the Stranglers and always wanted to play the Roundhouse. But here we were. Then you got Motorhead in the other studio. And it's kind of like, I'm chatting with John Gallen. And I said, oh, you know, how did you get into music kind of thing? And he's chatting and he said, I was tape hopping on Queen, you know, and you go, wow, you were miking up Freddie Mercury. For Seven Seas of Rye. And wow. You know, I couldn't get this into my head that this was the dream. This is it all along the line. You just can't believe these things happening. You know what it's like when you're just there and you suddenly go, you're speaking to somebody that you couldn't believe. I mean, I never got to meet David Bowie, but it would have been that moment.
Didn't he play marimba on Love Plus One? Was it? Have I got that right?
He thought pop record, that's what he was a genius at making at that point. I mean, we were learning, but we know this was, we could only dream about something like that.
I need to pay you back now, because you spoke a lot at the beginning about being influenced by Spandau and when you came along with that record and your look. If you look at the next video we make, it's called Lifeline. We are wearing furry stuff.
Mm.
all of us. And we are now thinking, yeah, you can be as pop as you like. Because,
yeah.
Because before you guys, we were all taking it very seriously. You know, really, you know, we had to, you know, it was much more, it's always, look, pop is art, but there was, it, this was more pure art, if you like. And now we're going to, we can be as commercial as we want. And I think me writing Lifeline Communication was because you'd allowed us to do that.
Ah, well, that's it's lovely. So, I mean, I feel like we're all influencing each other at that particular point and inspiring each other. But like a hotspot of things. I mean, Depeche Mode were, I mean, I remember they were appearing in Oh Boy and Girl magazines. And, you know, so at that particular point, it had just been the NME. And so suddenly Depeche Mode had gone really, really poppy. They'd really pushed the boat out and gone even more. So that made us do that as well. I remember it was Judy talking to Judy Totten, our press agent, and it was like, do you want to do this? And I thought, Depeche Mode is doing it. So it's the same kind of thing where you go, well, heck, 100 are doing it, you know, they're pushing it. And then it goes further that way, and then it gets to a point where it just kind of doesn't work anymore, and it goes back, doesn't it? And it goes serious, you know, and it goes through waves. And
well, I think what, you know, with Spandau, obviously, as it got bigger, we ended up, you know, you kind of make arena rock records, if you like. That's what you're sort of writing.
Yeah.
For you, there is a moment in 82 when you don't want to do this anymore, right? You don't want to be in that pop band. What?
No, I think I was just getting, it was getting serious. So I was on the coach, which, you know what it's like being in bands. It's the best job in the world, on the coach. On the coach, in between gigs, you're taken. You're being just taken somewhere to another show, and you're all together, and that solidarity on the bus, you can't beat that. It's a wonderful moment, and everybody just have their Walkman on, and listening to their influences. And so, I didn't have a Walkman at that. I think I had a cassette. Headphones, and I was just listening to the Beatles. Never heard such wonderful music. I couldn't believe I knew Penny Lane, but I wasn't listening to it so closely with headphones. When you listen to Penny Lane with headphones, you start to tuning into music a lot more and thinking what was probably possible now. You know, on from doing this to now, Bob is showing us a new place, and we're in the studio where Seven Seas of Riot is made. And Night at the Opera was made, you know, and Bohemian Rhapsody, which is, I still think, is one of the greatest pieces of music ever made, and recorded as well. They're just, it sounds like you've achieved another world there. That's if you want to know what the dream world is like, and, you know, what heaven's like, then there it is. Just listen to that. I mean, as soon as I put that song on, and, you know, that's that song, I know it's a big song for a lot of people, but It's key to me because it was posted through my letterbox by my first girlfriend, and when it landed and I put it on, you know, these were the records. These were magical things. They're not made on computers. They're not made on a grid. They're not made to be. They're not just kind of like, oh, let's compile a vocal here and a bit there. You know, these were magical times captured at that particular point. Nobody's made anything like Bohemian Rhapsody. And nobody's made anything like it since. And nobody probably can. It's like when Bob Dylan talks about, I can't do that. You know, when you've seen that YouTube clip where he's talking on, I think it's 60 Minutes, and he's asked about whether they're ever right blowing in the wind, you know, these beautiful lyrics and stuff. And he'll go, no. He's very clear, as Bob Dylan is, crystal clear about lots of stuff, but he knows he can't do that. And it's like that moment in time, Bohemian Rhapsody was made. You know, Queen didn't make it. Ever again, you know, it's that these are so times, you, it's like ripples. That song
felt that Haircut 100 had made what they needed to make.
Yeah, we'd made that, we'd captured that innocence, we'd captured it, we'd captured that childlike garden. Like Gary's saying, he's listening to Haircut 100. I was listening to things around, and you know, I was also listening to not just the Beatles and, you know, Simon and Garfunkel and all these wonderful things that I was discovering, but also just ABC and thinking. You know, Let's Kind of Love, what a grand statement that was.
You can hear that, you know, whistle down the wind, can't you?
Yeah, which is an amazing song.
Well, that was it. And I'd also, it was with me, it was Imperial Bedroom by Elvis Costello. I heard Town Crier. And I thought, that's something to aim for. Wow. That's, you know, and Elvis Costello's delivery on that album. And that was made by Jeff Embrick. And he was in the, he was in Air. And Dave, my friend at the time, who was, who seemed to be relating, because I wasn't really handling fame at all well. I don't think any of the band were. You know what it's like. It's really weird. You have short time to sort of get to grips with it, and everybody deals with it in a different way, and especially families as well adjusting to it, because they're really affected. I mean, my mum and dad were so affected by it, you know. And then their friends and everything. It spreads. Fame is like a strange Mexican wave. And it can, it's like through all the families and all the mycelium, you know, it just like spreads through the forest, and suddenly you've got this weirdness everywhere, and you've got to adapt.
Yeah, Guy and I are currently up to the bit where there's just one fat bloke who sort of half stands up and goes and gets embarrassed and realizes no one's doing it. That's our Mexican. That's where we have the Mexican wave of fame.
Yeah.
But how did you break it then to the news to the others?
Well, I wanted us to work with Jeff, and I couldn't convince anybody. And that was, it was starting to, things were starting to go strange at that particular point. Anyway, so
I've heard you say since, like, that in retrospect, there was actually a lot of it was to do with stress and stuff that you weren't dealing with at the time. And it wasn't, it's kind of not, you know, with the passage of time, how you saw it then isn't necessarily how you see it now.
No. Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing about life, isn't it? You can see really clearly where you made the not so good decisions, and the really good decisions and really bold moves. I can think of, name all the bold moves, like walking into the enemy and saying, walk up to Adrian Thrills and, that's Adrian Thrills from the film about Scar. That's him. You know, I'm sitting at his desk and he's like, what do you want? You know, kind of thing. How do you get in here? And I said, oh, I've just got my band. And, oh, no, but you've got demo tapes. What are they called? I said, Haircut 100. And you could see him kind of go, that's a good name. So I stayed. He kept me in the seat. It was like a really quick job interview kind of thing. Like, and that, so that bold move meant something happened there. And, you know, meeting Nick Logan from The Face in Carnaby Street with Adrian. Have you got any photos of the, or anything to share the back? You got band, yeah. You know, oh, here we are. And suddenly he put it in The Face on one of the earlier editions. And so we're becoming a band that was something. But it wasn't really. It was just, it's like my dad's toy factory. It was just a dream. Yeah, you know, you didn't have the stuff, but you had the dream of the stuff. And just like a dream of wanting to work with Jeff Emmerich and sound like Penny Lane and to sound like Town Crier. You know, I'd had these songs written, like A Whistle Down the Wind had developed, because that was a real slow burner, that song. That was a, that that was an indie song when we were like The Cure. It was like a forest was a, I loved that song. And so it was like, out the window, look what's happening, skinny black trees, they're not smiling, you know. That thing, and a little bit of Talking Heads still in there, so all your influence were laid really, really clearly out there, like bare, you know. And then was it more slowly that song had adapted into something else. Was it, I put more, a chorus into it.
Was it more, did it feel a bit more lonely without the band? Was there a moment of regret?
Well, at the time, I just, you know, it was a clear decision of, do you want to do this? Do you want to? Because I felt like I was always the leader, and I was leading, and at that point, I'd lost the leadership role, and lost the band. So
you work with Jeff Emmerich, who's, you know,
I mean, well, realizing that dream, was it, you know, that was that what you wanted when you
I wanted the band. I mean, we'd still be we would have been together all the way through and just making pop music together. That was the dream, you know, to be in a band and do that. I had no desire to go solo. I thought solo to me just looked like awful.
You could have called yourself Haircut 100, but then, or was there some, who owned the name? You came up with the idea, didn't you?
Well, it was Les Graham and I's dream, you know, on the coffee table in the ski club of Great Britain, getting serious once our girlfriends had chucked us. You know, that was basically it. That was like, right, let's do this. We'd all been in bands before, and we'd all been, had musical influence and done that. But this was like the moment where I mean, we were something all, you know, what led up to this moment. We were Captain Pennyworth the week before, you know, Blue Cereals, whatever it was. But suddenly it becomes serious when you, do you know that feeling when you suddenly thought, did you have a moment when you were suddenly called Spandau Ballet when it was like,
yeah,
it's, even though this isn't big yet, this feels like it's going somewhere. I really feel this.
Yeah, but and faith. Other people have to have faith. So that guy, you know, Adrian Thrills, and he, you meet Nick Logan, and they want to believe. They haven't. They, now, of course, you can just look it up and think, oh, he hasn't got many followers, or you know, I'll find a YouTube video of them, and yeah, it looks all right. There was only the imagination to spur on and create myth.
Yeah. And that's what you did.
To be fans as well. Of
yeah. Build.
Is it a play on Grecian? Is it a play on Grecian 2000?
No, it's not. It's well, it could be, but who knows with Nowhere Land? You know, with Nowhere Land, which we all pluck from. You know,
the ether. Yeah,
I mean, it's out of the subconscious. So, and I love wordplay and playing with words. And as I was a then commercial artist, I was always writing down words and playing with them and shifting them around and putting different letters everywhere and trying to come up with things. And so, you know, walking out of a demo studio and seeing West Pelican Wharf and thinking, wow, West Pelican, that would be a really good title for something or other. And, you know, I write them down now because I forget and stuff, but at that particular time just remembered that, and it was West Pelican for ages. That was the name of the going to be the name of the album. And then somebody, Arista, said, I prefer it the other way around. It's like, thank you. Yeah, of course it's that. You know, and that's the whole thing about people.
Yeah,
you
know, Pelican West sounded like some island in Florida that you wanted to go
to. Yeah.
Well, it's funny, but
if you're putting West after something, West Pelican is something English and parochial. Something West, it becomes like American and glamorous and exotic, doesn't it?
Well, that the dreams, I still think hang around and they're still with you, because we wanted to do a TV series set in a marina. We didn't know where the marina was going to be, but I imagined it to be some kind of flipper, something like Flipper. Or
you're going to call it Ender's East.
Yeah.
Flipper meets the Monkeys, right?
Well, meets the Monkeys, but also meets the Flying Doctor.
Oh, right.
You know, I saw a seaplane. I saw a seaplane in it somewhere. And some sort of Thunderbirds kind of rescuing stroke Tracy family thing where the palm trees went down. And then many years later, only of late, actually, Sarah, my wife and I, had ended up living in Key West in a marina. The guy who I'd recorded this song Kite with in the 90s, that sort of took off here in America, just of his own esteem, really. It was just took off one day. It was lovely.
Yeah.
It got stuck in a tree in the UK and then just took off here. On the independent radio. So I just followed it and had this new career over it. It was lovely for a while. But Ian Shaw, the guy that recorded it in this basement studio, 16 track in Fulham in Shorls Road, he decided to move to Key West and built this kind of ramshackle houseboat and put a little studio in it with his wife. And they were living there in this, it was like Cannery Row. It was like I think Shel Silverstein lived there at one point. He had a houseboat there. And it's this little art area in Key West because it's too expensive to live in town. So all the arty people live on the boats. And I went to see Ian and ended up like living with him. Sarah and I lived with him on his boat. We rented downstairs. And the boat but one was called West Pelican.
Oh my God.
And it was like that thing. I thought, well, I'm living in the TV series, you know. And it's funny because we were chatting the other day. I was down there visiting, looking at the houseboats as usual, to sort of like, we were going like, shall we get one? It's mad. They can blow away in a hurricane. It's a mad thing to do, but it's a brilliant lifestyle to actually up and be on this film set of Flipper. But
going back to my sort of core illustrator, you know, earlier, and I think, you know, if there was an architect reading all your lyrics, they would build Key West, wouldn't they? I mean, it looks like all of your songs put on an island.
It's a ramshackle place full of I mean, when I was recorded, I recorded there, and there was a studio, and it was a mahogany house. It was all, it looked like a this ship inside, like a galleon or something. And there was this drum kit in the corner. And we used the drum kit. This Joey Marciano, who is a local drummer and diver, he came along and played the songs. And he had no idea about my musical background or anything. He would just come to play on for $150 to play on some. He did 11 tracks in one session. And he was going, this is good. And he plays a bit like him. He's really kind of like got this kind of like, yeah, because he's used to playing in bands down there. You know, he's just like, because there's blues bands play all
what album
every
is
night.
This for?
Is this for an album in 2018 called Woodland Echoes? That I record.
I love that. I love the opening track on that album, actually. Is your son on that album?
Well, he was engineering a lot of that and producing because that's what he did. He did sound engineering at college. And so he looked after Zach Starkey's studio for a while and he became a brilliant sound engineer.
Are you, because you got the 40th anniversary of the album like next month,
West
right?
Pelican.
next month. And is there going to be some haircut shows?
Yeah, with the Shepherd's Bush Empire, 13th of May, I think that was on.
Be a trip for me and you, Guy, and Anthony.
Definitely. I was just thinking that's definitely a trip for us.
Yeah,
put us on the list.
Yeah, it's really good. We put it on sale and it sold out straight away. We were not expecting that.
You'll have to do another gig then, won't you? You'll have to, if you've sold it out already, you'll have to do some more. But you're also doing some chat shows plus playing with my old mucker Steve Norman, aren't you?
Yes.
Tell us about that, because that's coming up in about
any
week.
Chance to play with a band, you know. It's like
so go on. Where you're coming back to London for that?
Yeah, Pizza Express.
Promote it, Pizza Express.
Yeah, I mean it's gonna be Steve and I, a few stories, and we've no idea what we're gonna do, but we're gonna just do it anyway, you know. And I've played with Steve a few times at various things, and the confidence that oozes out of that man on stage.
Yeah, great musician.
He loves it. He loves being on stage, doesn't he?
He does.
And I love that.
He's got serious chops. Serious chops as a sax player these days. Yeah. It's got to be said.
Yeah, he enjoys it. You know, when I'm, you know, it's like that difference of being playing with some guys. No disrespect, but some session guys, and then there's band guys, and then you turn around, and Steve Norman's beside you, and he's going,
yeah, you know, up in the air. That is,
he's sliding down his knees, and he's really enjoying it.
So yeah, once he slid down his knees and he blew his knee, and we had to cancel the American tour. Nick, thank you for coming on.
By the way, I just want to say, because I didn't want to interrupt earlier, but my first band was a mod band and we used to play at the Wellington in Waterloo.
Really? Oh, what were you called?
Well, yeah, that's where I grew up in Waterloo. So
that's
my local gig.
That's a great area to grow up in.
Alaska Studios. Do you ever rehearse at Alaska Studios?
Yeah, all the time.
Street next to it. Yeah.
And Elephant. Yeah. Do you remember Elephant Studios?
Yes.
I did most of all my demos in Elephant in Alaska.
I am going to finish off with this text that's just come through from Steve Dagger, who knows I'm talking to you right now, but isn't listening in. He can't do.
It says, stop now, stop. You've said too much.
You owe him a fiver. and I'd forgotten this, that he and I saw you guys play in LA at the Palace in 1983.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was over there.
I remember that. Yeah.
That must have been
it's
the
there.
End of haircut.
It goes back 1982. You know, that was probably 92.
Still doing it.
It's a decade thing, you know. We're leapfrogging every decade. Well, hopefully we'll be leapfrogging into many decades more.
So what about new music?
I just do that all the time. I've got a studio together now in the UK. So that's my hub, my creative hub, where I'm doing lots of... And it's funny because I was playing...
Because you seem to bunch your albums together, don't you? You'll do one a year for a few years.
Well, I don't see it. I write songs. I mean, if I do have one regret in life, because I don't dwell on anything like that, but my one would probably be output, because I write hundreds of thousands of song ideas, but it's like a trod-on hosepipe. They don't get to go out there. I'd love to find a way to do that. And I think bands is a really good way to do that. But sometimes just, you know, getting all those songs finished, you know, I look at my phone and I think, not in my lifetime. I haven't got enough life left to finish all these songs. So Les and Graham were over to visit the studio and I was playing them some stuff I've just been recording, because I just see them as songs. That's what you do, and you finish them to the best of your ability. And if that is a studio and it's on Logic and you've got a pair of speakers and you've got Duet and this is it, then this is how it will be. And I like things to sound nice and dry and here, because I have no idea about sound engineering. So I just have it all here
at the front.
And I was just playing them stuff, and there's quite a bit of funky stuff. And Les was going, I really like that one. So you think, well, okay, that's it then. That's a haircut tune. So a new album is coming. Because I was just doing them anyway. And there's some of them that I don't think we'll probably do the one, you know, they're quite clear about what's haircut tunes. And that's the one that everyone likes, you know, if it's, because that's the way it used to be. You know, it's like, Gary, you've got song and you really like it. And the band kind of like go, yeah, it's really good, that one. You know, and it's like that moment with Coldplay when they're in the studio, in that famous studio in Wales, and they're
Rockfield.
That's the one, and they're in there, and it's to come up with a new song, and they're doing it, and Chris Martin's busy coming up with something, and he goes and plays the guys, and they're watching telly, you know, they've got a curry on, probably. Bit of disinterest about it until maybe, oh, I like that bit, and then, well, let's go in, and suddenly you're playing, and then, you know, it's like, oh, the bass player's really interested in the middle bit, you know, the drummer's quite into the getting a searching for a rhythm, and then as a singer songwriter you've got to, like, you haven't quite got the chorus yet, but then you look over and there's a yellow pages there, and you go, and it was all yellow. And then you've got a hit suddenly, because it's just all kind of come together in a very flow state, natural way. And
Nick, may the world keep inspiring you. And thank
likewise,
you.
Gary.
Thank you so
likewise,
much.
Guy. You know.
Thank you. We'll come and see you.
You know, we'll never be as young as we are right now.
Yeah.
You know, somehow you.
I used to see him in the Beetroot Club. Mm. Now I see him in Harley Street.
Well, I've bumped into you a few times, and sometimes I have said hello and sometimes I haven't, because as I said in the email, my hair was flopping, you know, and I thought, I cannot see that Gary Kemp with floppy hair. That's just
crossed the road.
Yeah, in Fitzrovia. Because, I mean, I go to Fitzrovia a lot. I'm always in Fitzrovia. It's a brilliant area.
Look at my dog.
And nine times out of ten,
sees the ponytail, I'm finished.
I see you, and I see Johnny Marr there. In Clutch, you know, Clutch Cafe.
That's a very nice shop. We like.
All right, yeah. That's some lovely clothing in there. I mean, I go in there and it's like Haircut 100 clothing.
All right, mate. All the best.
See you, Gary. See you, Guy.
That was so much fun. What a wonderful, engaging man.
He looks so bloody good still, doesn't he?
He looks so good. It's terrifying. It looks definitely a portrait in the attic. But I loved all the history stuff. It was really, really interesting just how plugged in he was back then to everything. When you think of Haircut 100 as this pop group, but they were so, you know, coming from that whole place that you did, you know, and the whole punk thing before that.
Absolutely. Brilliant. I do have to go because I've got to.
I know. The bard waits for no man.
So I'm sure I could have come up with a Shakespearean quote then.
I was trying to think of a line from Othello, but I can't think of any. Apart from the beast with two backs.
Thank you
really
to Ben
work.
Jones for producing and all the other people who help us out making this podcast for you every week. And we will be back next week with some other person in rock music, pop music, in this wonderful world. And until then, it's good night from me.
And good night from them.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.